This is Adam Shartoff, and you're listening to FilmWax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films and AT&T. Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 171 of FilmWax Radio. I'm really excited today because on this very episode, I am welcoming back Zachary Levy. Zachary was my very first guest ever on this podcast. It wasn't really even a podcast at the beginning. I was involved in an internet radio station, and I did my show, and then about, I don't even know, maybe a year into it, maybe not even that long, we started podcasting it. So back when Zachary was on, and I think that was in September of 2011, we weren't podcasting. So there you are. Anyway, Zachary and I remain friends, and his film Strong Man just got a digital distribution, meaning that it's now on iTunes and on Amazon, and and also it's on DVD. So we are putting together a bit of a screening and party tonight at Theater 80 in the East Village, where the subjects will be there, meaning Stan, Strong Man himself, and girlfriend Barbara. But all these details are on the show. I can just tell you it is tonight. If you're listening to this show today, Wednesday, October, I think it's the 23rd, then you will be able to come. And we are asking for a $10 admission. By all means, please do come to see us tonight. We'll be there. And the fun starts at 7 o'clock. Episode 171 is another documentary centric podcast. Also on this episode of FilmWax Radio is the filmmakers behind the film The Square, which opens on Friday, where it tells the story of the citizen uprisings. It's about revolution in Egypt. It's an exciting film. You're right in the very thrust of things. You're going to be shocked and awed by the film. And that's called The Square. And my guests are the filmmaker Jahan Najim and producer Kareem Amer. And they were really great. We sat down with them. And also on the show today, Jason De Silva, who is a documentary filmmaker. He's done a bunch of short format, mid-length format documentaries in the past. And this time he has made a feature-length documentary by turning the camera on himself shortly after he discovered that he was suffering from multiple sclerosis. He began to shoot his experience battling this neurological disease as it accelerated. So it's a pretty powerful film. Jason was really delightful, really sweet guy. And I appreciate that he brought me into his own home and talked to me so openly about everything. So, and Jason's film opens Friday as well, October 25th. Yeah. So without much hesitation, I want to jump right into things because we've got a nice, good, meaty show today. First up, my conversation with Jahan Najim and Kareem Amer.
Millions of Egyptians came down to the streets in nationwide protest.
This uprising defies any definitions.
People are gathering in the largest demonstrations against President Hosni Mubarak.
قرار السيد الرئيس محمد حسني مبارك بالتخلي عن منصب رئيس الجمهورية.
تتذكر قد ايه بالظبط؟ خليني احكي لك القصه ابتدت ازاي. ابتدت لما شويه شباب جدعان عشان يحاربوا الظلم والفساد والفقر.
ميدان التحرير!
حق الاخوان يوقفوا مع المجلس العسكري، المجلس العسكري اللي قتل شعبه.
خدوا الميدان واعملوا نفس عايشينه والثوره جايه.
Panel producer for Doc NYC, which I know that Judith Helfand has been, emailing.
Yeah.
I think you're going to decide whether you can make one of the panels
For it's the it's a chicken and egg panel for risking your subject. Were you able to make it? Or
I said yes.
Oh, okay. You did say it.
That's the one right before I was supposed to. Well, it was supposed to be the day I left for Egypt, but it's
right, hold this. And when you're talking, just hold it up.
Okay.
Yeah, more or less. Perfect. Dr.
Yeah, it's the chicken and egg panel, and I'm not sure
the date.
The subject.
It's risking your subject, so basically, it's when you shoot a subject and you're putting them at risk, and how you cope with. Or even potentially putting them at risk.
Right.
Or, you know, maybe you're planning on going somewhere where that could be an issue even. How do you deal with that issue? So let's say you're going to some guy that's start up some internet company. And you can tell there's going to be a crash coming.
My parents joked with me that I should call myself Disaster Productions at one point in time. Because, because... there was some kind of disaster, like the internet crashed, the war in Iraq, the revolution.
Those sounds you're hearing are the dulcet tones of Jahan Nujain. And we're also joined, she's the director or the filmmaker behind the new film, The Square. And then we're also joined by the producer of the film, Kareem Amer. I'm so glad that this worked out. So
thank you.
I'm glad to have you both on.
We're honored to be here. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Have you done podcasts before?
I think this is my first podcast.
Really?
I mean,
There's not that many film podcasts, although Eugene Hernandez has one over at Lincoln Center, so that's fine. Breaking the ice.
But no, it's great to be here. And actually, this porch that we're sitting on right now is where I did all of my interviews for Control Room.
Is that true?
10 years ago. Now.
It is almost 10 years ago. I was like kind of checking my records, and I saw the control. I wasn't positive, but I did. I checked, and I had seen Control Room in 2005.
That
is
makes
that
sense.
Possible?
That's possible. It came out in May of 2004.
Wow. Yeah. So I did. I saw it. I saw it online. It had to be one of the earliest Netflix. Right. Anyway, this is getting a little
no, that's right.
A little butt into the details here of my but I remember seeing it. Well, welcome in to big subject. The Square is in a very powerful document about which touches on I think a number of things that are converging in our lifetime. Right? And the main thing is that through the miracle of lightweight, inexpensive technology and the instant access to internet, we're not only able to create a revolution now, but be protected by it in a sense. The constant images of militia behaving aggressively towards protesters, their only weapon was
a camera.
The camera, yeah. And that's so. Can you talk about that and? You know, and maybe the origin story a little bit of the Square and what if that how much did that played a place in your storytelling?
Well, I think the lightweight equipment, the cameras, the internet, social media played a very important role. I don't think it's the reason why the revolution happened.
In Egypt, right.
The revolution has been. You know, there's a lot of people that have worked towards this happening for many, many years.
Sure.
But it was a tool, just like a rock is a tool. And it was a very, very powerful tool. I mean, as you know, people came down to the streets on the 25th of January because of a Facebook page that was put together for Khalid Said, who is a victim of police torture in Alexandria. And people rose up and... millions of people signed on to that Facebook page. And
it's miraculous.
Yeah. And we use these tiny lightweight cameras. Our cameras got confiscated. Our big camera got confiscated when we came into the country. So the only camera that we could use was the kind of camera you have over here, the Canon.
Like an SLR type camera?
Yeah. Mm. And because the reason why we could use them was because the police and the army didn't realize that they were video cameras at the time. So we used those.
Well, that cat's out of the bag.
That yes, they figured it out after about 6 months. We started getting those confiscated as well. So yeah, do you want to?
Hi, Kareem.
Well, I mean, I think that the the revolution in Egypt was really about finding your voice. And it was like a nation found its voice, a people found their voice, and they realized the power of that voice and how loud that voice could be when if you got enough people in a square to resonate and get a message out. And I think that, you know, the technology played a critical role in how people communicated. You know, so through Twitter became the news station of how, you know, you'd get updates on what's happening and what's going on and who's where. So if somebody saw an infraction happen, being like, okay, you know, you'd see a normal tweet would be, I see police or military storming over this bridge and about to enter the square. So that's how you'd know what's going on, you know, because the media wouldn't be telling you. And then you had the cameras uploading footage of what was happening and challenging the narrative of the state media, which wasn't showing what was happening. And you see that in our film, and you see that in many people who continue to kind of take the story into their own hands.
Yes.
And the graffiti, for example, played a similar kind of role. I mean, graffiti exploded on the streets of downtown Cairo as this revolution continued. And I mean, we have in Egypt quite a long history of writing on walls. But, you know, with the graffiti, it was incredible to see these artists coming together. And every time somebody would get killed by the military, there would be a stencil of their face created that night, and the stencil of that person would explode across the streets of downtown Cairo. I mean, and the authorities could not whitewash the walls fast enough.
Yeah. Well, explain though. So the first president,
Mubarak.
Mubarak, of course, Mubarak. So he's steps down after the revolution, correct? The first surge, let's say, and then he steps down. It seems as though the new regime is going to be much more, you know, cooperative, and also reflective of the citizens. And then, of course, that turns out not to be the case. It's a smokescreen, and so they are really let down. And then the new regime also learns how to kind of work this system a bit. They always seem to be a step ahead in the sense of how to sabotage the next attempt at revolution.
Yeah, I think, in terms of the rollout, the historical background of it, I mean, I think that what happened was a sense of awakening that the future will not change unless Egyptians become active. Mm-hmm. And people came down and that was an incredible moment when we were able to realize that we could topple Mubarak, and he did leave. And the country was the protesters trusted the military and entrusted the military to kind of usher in this transition to democracy. But there was a real betrayal to that transition, and there was a real kind of clamping down. And I think there was a misunderstanding by what the military understood the people wanted and what they did. And so the military failed to understand the goals of this revolution, you know. And when they did so, people rose up against them again. And then the Brotherhood came into power through an election. And the Brotherhood also failed to understand what the real people wanted and tried to turn it into an Islamic dictatorship. And when they did that, people rose up again. And so we see these waves, you know, happening in the last couple of years in Egypt, where any group that tries to kind of oppress the will of the people and steal power or not distribute power in an equitable way will find popular unrest against it. And this is a new sense of kind of understanding Egyptians have. It's like, well, you know what, if we don't like the president and they're not allowing us to have a constitution that has separation of powers and the tools to impeach a president or to use a legal way, we're all going to come down into the square. And so by the end of the film, you see, you know, it happened this summer where a quarter of the country's population came down to the street. Like, imagine a quarter of America in the streets, you know. It would you have 30 people now, a Tea Party have shut down D.C. Imagine if a quarter of the population came down and said, we're not doing this. So that's the kind of sense of empowerment that some Egyptians have today. And what we've learned through making this film is that it's not about the people coming down every day. It's about the dedicated few that you see, the characters.
Well, that's what I was...
who are willing to keep going every day and fight for little steps and are unwilling to compromise on those values.
Sure.
And there's almost, with these dedicated few that we followed in the film, there is an incredible emotional intelligence and understanding of
complexity.
What's happening.
Right.
And, you know, many times people would say, well, what do these kids in the square know? Half of them are uneducated. Half of them don't know how to read. But you look at somebody like Ahmed, and who just has an innate understanding of what's going on. A year before the Brotherhood steps down, he is in a cafe, you see it in the film, saying, the Brotherhood's finished. They're finished because
he's more prescient. He sees the bigger picture. He's a visionary. And he's barely out of his teens. I mean,
he's a visionary. He's 23 when the film starts, mm-hmm. and 25 and a half, almost 26 when the film ends. And you literally see him grow through the film.
I also like the complexities. You know, Ahmed comes across as very, very single-minded and very, despite his obvious level of intelligence and passion, he's also someone easy to grab onto because he's so fervent and he has such a single focus, you know. But somebody like, is it Magdi? Is a more complex person, and yet I really appreciate that you also made him complex because we could have dismissed him. We're liberal types or people that are very sympathetic towards the revolutionaries' goals here, because he's a bit at a crossroads.
Magdi was perhaps one of the most interesting characters we followed because he was torn and conflicted in a way that many Egyptians like him often felt. I mean, he had for 25 years, he was a loyal member of the Muslim Brotherhood, not on the upper echelons, but a foot soldier of the Muslim Brotherhood. And his beliefs he questions his beliefs midway through the film when he realizes that the Brotherhood are going for political power and taking power in the same way that previous regimes have. And he ends up siding with his secular revolutionary friends, which was an incredible process to watch. And then, you know, you have to see the film, but he goes through another evolution near the end of the film when he basically has to make a choice once again between his people that are being slaughtered and, you know, the sort of secular revolutionary friends whose beliefs he has become quite attached to.
And also Magdi, you know, he also represents a large percentage of the country, you know, I mean, as somebody and an important voice to have, as someone who is, you know, he's an electrician, he has 5 children, he has to deal with the realities as well of like how is he going to provide, how is he going to get his kids basic health care?
Who's got his interests in mind?
Exactly,
right?
Who's mm-hmm. taking care of him? And I think that the failure of the society to come up and provide an economic relief for someone like Magdi is what kind of crushes his hopes of the revolution succeeding and makes him need the safety net of the Muslim Brotherhood even more so. Because they provide an entire infrastructure for him, from educational support to his kids, to a kind of to healthcare allowance, to, you know, to job opportunities, you know. So it is really a way of life that he can't really escape out of. And also, I think it was important for us as filmmakers to show audiences that change happens, or the potential for change happens, when different groups of people come together. You know, I think that in America, it's important to show this message because the country has become so polarized. And if Egypt used to be like that, it is coming back to a polarized state now. But at the time when this revolution was really at its peak of potential, it was when the different walks, when the Magdi and the Ahmed and the Khalid, who's the more intellectual and has lived outside and represented, come together and decide to take their country's future into their own hands, that's when there's real opportunity for change.
Well said. I was going to say, generationally, he's definitely in a different place than Ahmed is and dealing with different issues, coming from a different place, which is kind of is a nice way in for maybe a segment of potential audience members abroad, or, you know, maybe even in Egypt. Will the film be seen in Egypt, or has it been screened in Egypt?
The film has to be seen in Egypt.
It has to be.
One of our biggest goals. And right now we are working on getting the film through censorship so that it can be shown publicly in theaters and on television. We're not there yet, but we have a plan B.
We've had private screenings.
We've had We've had private screenings.
Yeah, we've had private screenings, and there is a plan.
Okay.
To, if it gets banned, we're going to use some of the tactics you see in the film, where you know what was called cinema tahrir, where it's a projector and a sheet and an inflatable kind of mattress type thing that you can put across and set up your own outdoor cinema anywhere, and we'll just take it around the country.
Sounds like a large portion of the independent film scene here. I don't know about Egypt.
But it has been screened privately, and of course all of our characters have seen the film.
What was their reactions? I always ask this. What showing it to those guys?
Showing it to the characters.
Yeah, what did they... Did they feel...
No, they
represented well.
Well, it's the biggest compliment in the world that they do feel represented and that they feel like, you know, it's a difficult film to watch at times for them, but they do feel like it's truthful to their experience, which is a huge compliment.
And it's also been, you know, their perspective has been interesting because it's the last 2.5 years in Egypt have been very intense and have been very kind of focused on the moment. So people have been living moment to moment to moment. And the narrative also outside has been written from a moment to moment perspective, right? So it's like, what are the events of this week? Or what are the events of last summer? But to see it kind of, the through lines have been missing. And so I think what the film does is it gives an opportunity to see how these different moments add up together. And when you do that, you realize that what's happening is a process that's unfolding. And it's more important to understand the process than to understand what happened on each particular day.
I know your theatrical here is coming up a week on the 25th of October.
25th of October.
Yeah.
We'd like to pack the theater, please.
That's your first goal. Right. Get them in and then get them out and get the next ones in. So the kinds of responses you're getting from American audiences...
Oh, the response here has been incredible and has reached Cairo. And I cannot tell you what it means to the characters in the film and the people that have been fighting on the ground for the last 3 years that there has been such a positive response that people relate to the characters in such a deep and emotional way.
Yes.
You know, it's a film about people power. And so to have won the audience award at 2 major festivals to them is saying to them, we get it, you know. And we relate to you, and we're the people. So it really makes a difference.
And one of the reasons why it also makes a particular difference is because our characters and many of the people in the square really feel that what's happening in Egypt is part of a global paradigm shift. That there is a sense that that the social contract that was broken in Egypt and that people are trying to rewrite now is also falling apart in many other countries and societies across the world, and that this idea of building a society of conscience that Ahmed says at the end, you know, that's really what it's about. It'll only succeed if it becomes a global idea. If people around the world start to claim their rights more regularly and start to realize the interconnectivity of what's happening. So the events in Egypt and the failures of citizens to protect their human rights affect the fight for human rights in all over the world, you know. And when we turn a blind eye to infractions of those rights, we're losing our rights as everyday citizens, no matter where you live. And I think that's increasingly a spirit that people need to tap into. And we saw, you know, if you talk to Ahmed, you know, you know, there was a reason why from Egypt you saw Occupy Wall Street, you saw Athens, you saw Moscow, you're seeing Rio still unfolding. So the sooner we start to realize that this is not just a local issue but a global issue, I think we'll have a better understanding of the fight for justice in the 21st century and what it's going to look like.
It's also refreshing to watch stories like The Square, again, opening October 25th here in New York, because a lot of the stories we're seeing of the fundamentalist uprisings we're seeing are kind of on the other end of the spectrum in the sense of diminishing human rights, it appears, you know. And so this is nice to see some emphasis on these also, or that these revolutions are effective and they're happening.
And I think what people will look back on and remember when you look at the macro you know, of what happened recently this last summer on June 30th is you had millions and millions of people coming down protesting against President Morsi because he was using religion to effectuate the exact same situation as Mubarak had and as the military had. And they were basically saying, you will not, you know, whether the face of fascism is Mubarak or the military regime or the Muslim Brotherhood and Islam, this will not be used, you know, under my watch. And this is the most populous country of the Middle East. All of the, a lot, Arab countries look towards Egypt as to what's happening. Mm-hmm. And this is the first time that Muslims, devout Muslims in such vast numbers came down and said, no, separation of church and state. I mean, this is a founding period. This is the first time that that has been put on the table by the people in such a major way.
Right.
And in order to get there, we needed to go through Muslim Brotherhood rule for a year. So this is a process, I believe, that is a very important process that we're going through right now. And there's a tendency in the West to say, okay, so this has failed. It's a failed state now because the military is taking control again. No, what happened in January of 2011, what's happened on June 30th, what's happened in all of the bits in between are that people are losing their fear and standing up for something that they believe in that is bigger than themselves. And there's Khaled talks about meeting a taxi driver who says, you know, look, it's either you take me or you take me and my kids and my grandkids and my grandkids' kids, so it's better that you just take me. And that is the feeling of people on the streets.
It's been amazing to see audiences here where they understand that, you know, it's not just about Egyptians claiming their rights. You know, I mean, the goal of we have is not that everybody rises up in the U.S. and starts to sign a petition for Egypt. The goal is for anybody is for people to claim their rights towards any activity they feel is important to them. So seeing people in the environmentalist movement who've come out of the film and said, you know, we talk here about how much we want to change the laws on the environment and how much we want to, but are we willing to, how far are we willing to go? Are we willing to sacrifice everything like these people in Egypt did?
Right.
You know, same with the LGBT community. We met a lot of interesting activists there who were really inspired by the film and felt, you know, this is very important for people to understand that change is difficult and rights are never given. They're always fought for.
One of our executive producers is one of the founders, Jody Evans, of Code Pink. And so the reason why she loves the film is not that it in particular is about Egypt, but because it's about the fight for change and what that actually takes. And nobody sees, people see the successes of change, the Million Man March or whatever, but they never see Martin Luther King or Gandhi when they're alone and lonely and have been left by all their friends and family and nothing's working and they feel like they failed. And it's important to see, you know, that entire movement, the lonely times as well as the successful times, the defeats. And one of the most exciting screenings personally for me has been at a high school in Utah where we showed it to a bunch of kids who came and, you know, a few of them came to us afterwards and said, you know, this was the most inspiring film I've ever seen because people, these kids felt so alive. They felt so alive and connected to what they wanted and principled. And if they can feel that and they can fight for that and they can lose their life fighting for it, then it really made me think about what I'm doing. And so this is where we're, as Kareem said, this isn't about Egyptian politics. This is about looking at possibility. And it personally was a revolutionizing 2-3 years for me personally. I mean, my whole understanding of what's possible has changed.
Beautiful. Well, thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Kareem, Amr, and
Thank you.
Thank you, Jahan Nujaim.
You can go to the
please.
You can follow us at the Square Film, and also the Square Film on Facebook and thesquarefilm.com. Or at The Square Film, Twitter, and on Facebook, /The Square Film.
And I'll put those in the show's notes, too, just
Thank
so people
you.
Can find you guys. Oh, yeah, my pleasure. Thanks, guys.
Cool.
When I Walk is one man's emotional and inspiring journey. During 6 years of life following his multiple sclerosis diagnosis, for Jason De Silva, life's most challenging and joyous moments are yet to come. We don't give away all those joyous moments, but I could tell you that to say that Jason is making the best of the deal he was handed is an understatement. He was really someone who I immediately connected with, and I hope that comes across somewhat in our interview. I was, as I said earlier, in Jason's home. His wife was there. I will say that the microphone that he was talking into had to be held by his aide, also, he doesn't have a lot of power in his voice, so you may, at a few points during the course of the recording, you may miss some of what he's saying, but very little. And it's almost negligible, but I thought I'd mention that. But he was really one of my favorite guests, so I'm happy to introduce my conversation with Jason De Silva.
As a kid, I discovered filmmaking. This was me 5 years ago, making documentary films and traveling the world. And then I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis.
When you feel down, think of other countries, other people.
I get a film grant and take off for India. Maybe I can find something here to make me better. But I'm getting worse so fast, I feel like my time is running out.
I had no idea that this would happen so fast.
How long is the show?
It's the other thing. Doesn't matter. It's liberating, you know. Yeah. But what I do is sometimes I'll do, like I did an hour with a couple of friends of yours. I did an hour.
Okay, with who?
They with Michelle and Joe.
Joe.
I mentioned I was coming to do the show, and they told me, oh, we know Jason, of course. I knew that you knew them. That was great.
How was their screening?
Hold it,
did
like.
They talk about
it? Yeah, that's perfect. Yeah.
How did they talk about their New York Film Festival?
Yeah. Well, I
should. How was it?
We're talking with Jason De Silva, by the way, who did not make American Promise. He made a different film called When I Walk, which we're going to get to. But friends of his made this movie, American Promise. I actually saw the POV edit.
I saw the cut.
Which is a little shorter.
A lot shorter, isn't it?
How probably 15 minutes to 20 minutes, I think.
Oh, okay.
So I saw that, and I was traveling, and I just watched it on a link, you know. I didn't have an opportunity to see it during the New York Film Festival. I interviewed them actually last Sunday night, so the festival just ended.
Oh, so after?
Yeah.
They're doing their theatrical run 1 week after I am.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, it begins.
It's funny, we have similar paths. We're both in Sundance. We did different.
No, their
festivals.
Theatrical is going on a week before yours.
Theirs, oh, really?
Yeah, theirs is going on now.
Oh, I didn't know.
Yeah. Oh. Yours is after theirs. Their theatrical, they got a good review. Well, reviews, they're generally
times
good.
Times and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And yours is opening, we know, Friday.
Yep.
The 25th.
Yeah.
Right, I got that right, October 25th.
Yep,
that's right. And where is it going to be playing?
It's going to be playing at the IFC Center.
Nice. You're going to be there, of course.
Course.
How many screenings are you going to go to?
It's going to be Q&As. I'm going to go for the first three minimum, but it's playing for a week straight.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on that.
Thank you.
But this is hardly your first documentary.
No, this is actually my sixth documentary. It's sad to say that I've done it for this long.
Why?
But it's nice. I mean, I've started off.
Well, you're kidding,
shorts.
Though.
Well, yeah. I started off doing shorts and then a couple of mid-lengths. But this is actually my first feature.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
I didn't realize. Okay, very good. So you did a couple that were like closer to 40, 45 minutes or
yeah,
so.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And not only did you make your first feature, but it's about yourself.
Yeah, it's a totally different genre than anything I've done before.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the same as everything I've done before in the way that it's a documentary, but it's very different because it's
autobiographical documentary, which lends itself to Morgan Spurlock, Michael Moore, filmmakers that put themselves in on the camera.
Oh, so right. But they don't make personal documentaries.
Let me rephrase.
Morgan Spurlock, you could say, but he's very issue-oriented. He's just using himself as a subject. But Morgan makes films about broader subjects.
Yeah. And the way that mine was personal from start to finish.
Yeah.
Michael Moore uses his personal relationship to Flint, Michigan as a catalyst in Roger and Me, things like that. But they don't have the same type of intimate personal journey that I had in my film.
Right. And yours, it wasn't chosen. Morgan says, I'm going to supersize, the next month of food or however long it was. Whereas you didn't choose to let me have MS as an experiment. Let's see how that goes.
I wish.
I know. And then you could just turn it off. Yeah. And that was the other thing. I said, you're making a personal documentary. Your seventh film sixth film is a personal documentary. And B, it's not like you have headaches. This is something that's affecting your entire body. And your ability to work and making a film is a physical job. You have to shoot the film. You have to edit the film. You have to.
I know.
And it probably took like a lot longer.
Yeah, that's why it took 7 years. But at the same time, if I was able-bodied and things were just fine, I'd probably have done all that myself. Because that's what I enjoy doing. That's why I made 5 films before this one. It's because I was able to do all these things myself.
So you were making your fifth film, and then you discovered that all of a sudden your body wasn't behaving in familiar ways?
It was actually during my fourth film.
Fourth film.
So I went out there and made another film while I had MS. But it was during my fourth film that what was happening was out there shooting. I was down in the tragedy of Hurricane Katrina. And I was shooting a brass band after Hurricane Katrina that was all separated and slowly came back together again.
The musicians?
Yeah, musicians. Oh, wow. It was a beautiful film. But what was happening is I was staggering a little bit and my vision was getting blurry. So I finally, a year later, I finally went and got it checked out.
So you waited a year. Is that just denial?
I think it's a combination of everything. I think it's a combination of denial, but it's a combination of me being 25 at the time and thinking that there's obviously nothing wrong with me. I'm just 25 years old. And then third, I think that it's also the fact that I didn't have medical insurance at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I understand that all too well. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you waited a year, as you said, and then you finally decided to go get checked out.
Yeah, finally. And that was, it was getting worse and worse and worse. So by that time, I was like falling down the stairs. I was really walking like I was drunk everywhere I went.
So it was that dramatic before you went to get checked out?
Say it again?
It was that dramatic. And then you realized before you actually got to the point where you got it checked out.
Yeah.
By then, though, you must have had lots of conversations with your close...
It was actually my mom that was... I was in visiting her over Christmas. And she said, just take a quick run down these stairs. Let's see, dude. And I just fell head over heels. And I fell down the stairs.
I don't know what to think about your mother encouraging you to do that after you were... Like, maybe there was a safer test. Did you wear a helmet?
Probably, yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Well, your mother will come back to her in a moment.
Yeah, but I wheeled downstairs. She went to the computer, taped in falling downstairs, and the first thing that came up was multiple sclerosis. So she said, this is serious. You need to get it checked out. Please, when you get back to New York, get it checked out. So that's exactly what I did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So within 2 weeks, I knew what I had.
And what was your? This is in the film. You talk about it right? What was that like when you got that diagnosis?
I surprisingly it wasn't that crazy to me. I just kind of kept on going with with the rest of my life.
Yeah.
So the reason for that is I think that I was 25. I was really living. It was 2 years before I had my first feature or my first short at Sundance. Mm-hmm. So I was doing really well. The last thing that I have time for is a weird disease.
Right.
So I just kept on going and things were just fine. Mm-hmm. But quickly I learned that MS just really wasn't going away. And there's no way to stop it. Yeah. So I turned the camera on myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Were there other cases that you were familiar with where a filmmaker did such a thing?
There was a film called So Much So Fast that was documenting a man with ALS, mm-hmm. but he didn't actually turn the camera on himself. There was...
Probably filmmakers with cancer, maybe, or...
Yeah, there was or I forget the name of it, but there's a small history of films of people about doing POVs about themselves after they get a disease.
Yeah.
Of some kind. Yeah.
I think the thing that was surprising, if I'm not incorrect, was how quickly the disease progressed, right? I mean, yeah. I thought because you were young, you were healthy, and there are, I guess, just as many cases where it does take a little longer. I mean, you know, there is an inevitability that it's going to affect your entire neurological system over time, but it could have taken a lot longer, but it seems like things really went really quickly. It was really surprising.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, granted, you're still watching 7 years of my life in a 90-minute movie, so right. Things go really
quickly. Sure, sure. And,
but
I assume you weren't filming all the time, too.
Yeah, I kind of was. But...
Well, I feel sorry for your editor.
Yeah, yeah. But what was happening was... my kind of MS, primary progressive, is a lot faster just in general than okay. the MS population, which has relapsing and remitting MS, whereas like 30 years of somebody takes 7 years for me. Yeah. So it's faster and it's hard hitting, but it also makes for a good film.
I guess there is that way to look at it. Yeah. Hey, let me ask you a question, though. Are there plateaus... though, like in general, like, or is there, have you hit a plateau where there's a length of time where you're kind of basically feeling pretty much the same, you know, for a long time?
You know, that's the course of MS usually. It gets better and it gets worse and gets better.
So it does
worse.
get better. So you might go where times where you have less difficulty with certain tasks just in general.
In theory, yes, you would. And most of the population does. But primary progressive doesn't.
Okay.
So it's steady. So we don't get these relapses, these up and down things. We just get like a nice steady progression that gets worse and worse. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So at first I was getting worse and I was waiting for those moments where I was getting better. Mm-hmm. But lo and behold, those moments never came. So it just got worse and worse and worse. So year after year... so this consistently got worse. Mm-hmm. So around year 3 or 4, that's when I realized what I was up against. Yeah, it is what it is today.
I assume, though, your mood and the way your coping mechanisms can't be directly related. Your arm's getting tired. Where you can, there can't be a direct relation because you'd be gone. I mean, you would have given in and be under a blanket and you know what I'm saying. So obviously... I know you have moments where you feel defeated. It's even in the film as well. But there also must be... but as you have already said, life goes on.
Life goes on.
And
yeah.
this is the way it is. But
I mean, I'm not going to say that it's not impossible, because it is impossible what I'm dealing with. And there are moments that... I mean, there's moments every day, every hour, where I'm just like discouraged and defeated. Like even just sitting at the computer and not being able to... lift up the mouse or do something and asking my aide or helper just to lift something mm-hmm. that I normally could have done just 6 months ago. Moments like that, it's like completely discouraging. Mm-hmm. But on the flip side, I know that there is a story to be told. And at the end of the day, it's like I'm a creative person and I'm a filmmaker and that's what I love to do. So I'm going to try and just keep doing that as long as I can.
Well, let's talk about the filmmaking a little bit then. you had to still keep in mind, even though this was about you, this was about something, a major challenge in your life. But at the same time, you also had to make a film that was, an entertaining film and something you can market. And I wonder about that and how you took on the role of filmmaker, not just Jason, the subject of the film, but also the filmmaker, Jason. You know, could you sort of be practical about your approach to making the film? And
yeah, you know, that's a very good point, because I thought, and like myself as a filmmaker early on, I presumed that audiences would be there to see your film and like use the, you know, just like the benefit of the doubt that you're making a film that's going to appeal to the masses and that they were just given open try. But the disease film genre, I feel people steer clear of it. So it doesn't matter sometimes that I've made an entertaining piece that is like a story about triumph over tragedy, that is lighthearted, that, you know, it's quick pace, it's fun. There's a lot of really great elements to it.
Mm-hmm.
You're still categorized. What's that?
You're still categorized.
Exactly. Yeah. You're still categorized or I'm still categorized. And, you know, at the end of the day, there's going to be people that just don't want to see my film or hear about it just because of the genre that it's in,
mm-hmm.
which is really is too bad to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I agree. When I was walking by into your home, I met your wife, who's, you know, who you meet in the course of the 7 years of your film, and you meet.
Yep.
Right. Sure. Yeah. And right, you were quite I have to put this carefully. You like the ladies. Yeah. You seem to be like to go out, and you like female attention.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, that's a good way to put it. So. I assume you still do. But you've met the woman of your dreams, the woman that you would end up sharing your life with. And there is a lot of dimension to the film. It's not just about disease. Right. It's also about a guy living a full life.
Yep,
exactly. At the same time.
Quit your film right now. How does it feel? Just quit.
I'm not going to quit the film.
To help me gain perspective, my mom takes me to an MS support group. There was this girl there. Her name is Alice, and I got her phone number. I decide to give Alice a call. I may be walking slower, but inside, I'm racing.
That was really, really fun.
I sent an email to my dad, and I said, can you date someone with MS? And my dad said, yes, I'm dating someone with MS right now.
Do you ever wish that you're with somebody able-bodied?
Yeah, but I wish you were able-bodied.
He's like this incredible person. It's not right.
Another family member who plays a prominent role in the film is your mother.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Who all but pushed you down a flight of stairs, apparently, early on.
Yeah.
But no. But she plays the angel on your shoulder or some degree, someone who is prodding you on and not letting you get too down or
really,
let you focus.
Really, that's great, because I, as I was cutting the film, mm-hmm. I kind of pigeoned her as the comic relief character of the film. So
there is that, yeah.
So it's a combination of the two, I think.
Yeah. No, totally. I can see that totally. Yeah, she's a, the typical mother, certainly in my case, the typical Jewish mother is, well, let me just do everything for you. And, of course, you know, you can cry on my shoulder kind of thing. Your mother wasn't putting up with that. Stop feeling sorry for yourself. She wasn't really going to let you go there, right? And she sort of kind of caught on. She kind of caught on to that pretty quickly, like... Yeah, so you see quite a bit in the seven years. Were you ever plugged into sort of the documentary community? It seems like you were.
Of course. Yeah, for sure.
It's a small community.
It is a small community.
And
yeah, it was definitely. I was working with POV, PBS POV, for three films before this one.
Oh, you did? Okay,
yeah,
very good.
Yeah, so I did quite a bit. I showed it to Rebecca twice before. I had a film at Sundance before, so mm-hmm. yeah, I was doing really well. Had a film at HBO, yeah.
And now When I Walk has a broad theatrical, right? It's going to be here. Is it? It's also in L.A.? Or
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be here in L.A. for a week each, and then it's kind of rolling out to other cities.
Right.
It's doing a theatrical as well in Canada at the same time.
Oh, nice. Very good.
Yeah.
And tell me about also the mapping component you designed were part of designing.
Yep. No, I designed it actually from scratch. I came up with the idea in 2007 after I got my first iPhone, and I said that there really is going to be – this is a great way to actually get out there and use the iPhone technology and web technology to find all the wheelchair-accessible places around you just because no database like that existed. So I came up with Access Map, which is axsmap.com, mm-hmm. and it's a free and easy way to – search for all the wheelchair accessible places around you. So that's kind of like the side component along with When I Walk.
That's terrific. So wait, are you saying that this exists exist in different cities or where would this app apply?
It's actually really exciting because it's powered by Google's API. So any place that's on Google is going to be on the map. So it's really powerful in that way. So it's using API technology so that it was expensive. More expensive than the film, actually.
Is that true?
Yeah, it's actually more expensive to build than the film. But it's hopefully, you know, I've been a filmmaker for 5 to 10 years now. I know that a film has a shelf life of 2 years, if you're lucky sometimes. But this hopefully will live on for generations.
Yeah, that's great.
And, you know, anybody can get out there and use it and review. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so and people can just go onto the App Store.
Yep, App Store and
or
go on the website.
Or Google
AXSMAP.com.
Yeah. What is it again?
AXSMAP.com.
AXSMAP.com.
Yeah, it's called Access Map.
Got it. Thanks. Do you have plans for another film that are you going to make?
Yes, I do. And it's like I'm slowly putting things together. It's going to be about portrayal of disability throughout media and media and specifically looking at cinema, but then relating that to real life situations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know how much I'll be on camera for this one, but, you know, I might just be. We'll see.
Yeah, you'll figure that part out, whether it works within the context of however this film turns, the next film turns out, if it belongs or doesn't.
Yeah,
and that's where, again, that filmmaker comes in, you know, that tension between the filmmaker and subject. And
yeah, that's right.
And you mentioned a couple of filmmakers that do that pretty well, or have done it certainly successfully, you know, with Michael Moore or Morgan Spurlock. Are there other filmmakers that you... I don't know, that...
inspire me?
Yeah, well, I don't usually ask that, actually, but it just sort of came to mind.
Well, outside of that genre, participatory documentary, I really like the work of Earl Morris, other documentarians that I...
Well, let me invite you, because, you know, I'm also programming... I produced the panels for DocNYC this year.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Wow, that's great.
And
it the one that happened, or it's about to happen?
It's about to happen. Yeah,
that's great.
And next month. And at IFC Center.
Yeah,
but the
great.
Opening night film is, you know, The Unknown Known.
Earl Morris?
Yeah, his new film.
Wow, that's great.
U.S. premiere.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I should go.
You should go.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll try to help work that out if you're interested.
That's great. I'd love to. That's cool.
Yeah. You know, again, let's repeat, though, that When I Walk is Jason's film. It's going to be at the IFC Center. Is that the only theater here?
Yeah, it's the only theater that will be in New York.
Okay, so it'll be
in Brooklyn at the Indie Screen.
We'll see. Oh, at the Indie Screen? You're talking to Marco?
Yeah, we'll see.
It's not, I mean, film is...
We're showing at the JCC Uptown.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But that's not a theatrical.
It's going to be for...
They're showing it for four days. Okay, yeah. So it's a variation. But you're getting But the beauty part is you're getting your theatrical at the IFC Center, so you can do things like that. You can do, yeah. So you're getting the reviews.
Yeah. The Canada has really supported this film. So, because I'm dual citizen, U.S. Canada. Oh,
okay.
So
is it your mom up in Toronto?
In Vancouver.
Vancouver, excuse me.
So won the best Canadian doc at Hot Docs and won the audience award at Vancouver.
Oh, terrific.
So it's great. So we'll be doing my theatrical thing out there.
Great.
Yeah.
So congratulations on that all around. And
thanks.
I look forward to the film doing really well. You know, and then hopefully it'll get a broadcast.
Oh, well. It's going to be on POV.
Oh, it is on POV?
Next year.
Oh, yeah. We can announce that?
Yes, please.
Oh, fantastic. Because I even worked there for a little while. So.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
So you worked with Chris and Simon. And...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, cool. If one of the panels we're doing that I put together is a POV. We're going to be looking at Brooklyn Castle, like the whole trajectory of that film.
Oh, yeah, cool.
You know, from, you know... The whole thing.
It's like a case study.
But yours would have been equally good, actually, now that I think about it.
No, Brooklyn Castle is really cool in the way that they really pulled together a grassroots effort to get the film out there.
Yeah, very much.
Far more than me. Like, I know that their whole thing was, like, with the stadium being built and having screenings around that,
mm-hmm.
protest of that. It was neat. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, maybe you can come to that panel, too, if you're free. If anything, I'm going to be at the two chicken and egg panels because...
Is Doc NYC at...
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they have a couple... Like, they're opening... I think the Errol Morris is actually going to be at the SVA Theater. But the majority of the screenings are at IFC Center, and all the panels are at the IFC Center.
Cool.
And on the ground, I'm sure.
I'll email you about the Errol Morris thing.
Yeah.
That'd be great.
I'll see what I can do. Okay. Well, thanks, Jason.
Thank you.
All right.
Yeah.
Come back on soon.
Thanks. It's hard to know where our stories are going as they're being written. That's the mystery of fate.
Last up, Zachary Levy's back. My very first guest ever has returned on this, the 171st episode of Filmwax Radio. Again, Zachary and I will be at the Theater 80 tonight starting at 7 o'clock. So if you are of the mind, come out. Or if you're in the city, stop by. Just hang out with us for a while. And hang out with Stan LaSteele and girlfriend Barbara. And there may even be other people there from the film, Strongman. For information, I guess you can go to strongmanfilm.com or filmwax.com or go to our Facebook page. You can just search Strongman DVD Release Party because that's what it is. So and Stan will be there signing copies of the DVD. All these details, we're going to talk about it in just a second. So, and oh, yes, during the course of this conversation, Zachary thought it would be real clever to turn the tables and turn the microphone toward me, so to speak. And so at some point during it, he starts interviewing me. So, you know, I humored him. I submitted for a little while. But by and large, we're talking about Zachary and his film Strongman. And now I hope that he goes on after this to make other wonderful films as powerful as Strongman. Anyway, so yes, so here it is, my conversation with Zachary Levy.
You did some stuff with bending some metal pipes, didn't you?
I do. I bend the strongest bars in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I thought so.
They call me Stainless Steel. The strongest man in the world at bending steel. I actually can bend coins in my fingers.
Ladies and gentlemen, I bring to you the moment you've been waiting for.
I can't mess this up because I only have like a few more shots. That's all I got.
You're the best at what you do. It's finding the right peg to fit the hole, so to speak.
Here he goes.
I love my brother. He's a nice guy. I like to hang around with him a lot.
My hands are armored. I've got tremendous power, and I can't be hurt exactly. If I want it.
Hi, Zachary.
Hi, Adam.
It's good to have you back on the show.
It's good to be here. It's different environment since I was last here.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Since you were last with us, yes. Which was...
I was in a shipping container the last time I was with you.
Yeah. We're here in the offices of Rooftop Films.
How is that working out, that partnership?
Oh, so far so good. Yeah, I think everybody's happy. And very fruitful because, you know, you just get all sorts of opportunities for guests to come on. It's nice. It's great. Yeah. But you have the unique honor.
Yeah, absolutely.
I guess it's an honor. I don't know. For me, too. For it to be my very first, having been my first guest on this podcast. So it's really great, you know, in that way.
If you make it really big someday, I'm going to be like a footnote to a trivia question of a trivia question or something.
Well, you know, that's a reach. But it will always mean something to me because, you know. You came on. I don't think we knew each other very well at the time, but we knew each other a little bit, right, back then?
Yeah,
we had been running into each other already.
I think we had met a couple of times over the... We'd run into each other a couple of times, but...
But we met originally because I reviewed Strong Man.
Right.
When it first came out in the theaters.
Right.
And it was at the IFC Center.
Right.
And I had no idea how it came on your radar. My guess is that maybe somebody at IFC Center or...
Yeah, it was probably on like, I think on their emails when they send out a list of the upcoming films, right?
Don't maybe. Do yeah. And so...
I'm not on their press list, but...
but anyway, no, but the strange part was that I just remember saying, the filmmaker will get in touch with you, which was a little, even then, unusual because you usually get contacted by publicists. And then it was like, you called me, or you did you? Or do you,
no, you, would,
you arranged for a ticket.
What,
it already come. Left, it was like the next day, or it was like a Saturday or something.
Right. I mean, you would want it to see a press. I think at that time it had already started its run, perhaps.
Yeah,
or was
it did.
Just about to start. Its
no,
run,
it just ran. So. It was already. Yeah, it was the next day.
So yeah, it was just that was the best way to do it. Was just see it the way it's supposed. You know, see it in the theater. Like
No, it's true. It's very true. You know, if you don't have to worry about being part of the machine that is promoting it so people go see it opening weekend, then you do get to see it with people in the theater, and it is nice. And then was really pleasantly surprised because it was such a moving, deep film about this larger-than-life in every manner of speaking character in Stan. And then, you know, I guess I wrote the review. I don't really remember exactly who it was for, but I just remember then we met at some point subsequently, but then running into each other over and over and over.
Right.
And to this day, we just keep running into each other. So we don't even have to make plans.
Right.
Chances are tonight we would have run into each other anyway, even if we hadn't planned to for you. So welcome back.
Well, thank you.
A long-winded way of welcoming you back. One of the reasons we're together, besides just sort of having you back on, which was we've been talking about doing for a while anyway, before you even, I think, knew that you were going to have a digital distribution, right?
Right.
We had already been talking about it. But that's come about. Finally, Strong Man's going to be on DVD. It's going to be on iTunes.
iTunes.
On Amazon.
All the shortened platforms, acronyms, and that's great.
How does that feel?
It's exciting. It's exciting. I mean, it's exciting. I think that, you know, when you do these things, I didn't really know what I was doing to an extent, you know, like I was making a film and that's what I cared about. You know? But it feels really nice that the film has gotten to that point where there's a demand for it, you know, because for the longest time, I think I felt like the film couldn't exist unless I was breathing into it, you know, whether I was making it actually. And at a point where no one cared whether I didn't go back the next day to shoot or if I did shoot the next day. I mean, there was a long period of time, years when, you know, you're making it in a vacuum. And then, even after I got on the festival circuit, there was a lot of pushing on my part just to kind of keep it
momentum,
you know, keep it going. Cause it never really had,
you had to create the momentum.
It was never, there was never like
team strong.
No, there was no, you know, it was,
so, Remind me, because I didn't know you then, and I didn't wasn't aware of the film back then.
Right.
What festivals that you had?
Well, it started at Slam Dance, which was great.
Yeah,
terrific. Yeah, and I mean, I shouldn't say that it had no momentum. It actually had a lot of momentum for a truly indie film, but. And there were certainly always programmers and festival people who were really enthusiastic about it. And I know, you know, it would not have gotten to this point without their support, you know. But it also wasn't a film that the industry was necessarily really ever aware of, you know. And
there was no anticipation.
Yes. Yeah. There
finally. But it was also your first feature, yes, so there usually isn't.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think it was a combination of me being unknown. Also... I didn't have a sales agent. I didn't have the apparatus around it, which often introduces a new film to the market, you know? So, and to be honest, I wouldn't say it was just external things. I mean, there was probably a part of me too that was, you know, I had spent so long on the film, you know, I wasn't quite ready necessarily to put shrink wrap on it, you know, in a way. I wasn't quite ready to say, like, I remember at Slam Dance, you know, I didn't have a trailer when I went to Slam Dance. I just had the film. And part of that was my own ignorance and not knowing, you know, I sort of assume like, oh, people will watch the film and they'll like it and, or they won't like it or something will happen, you know, and it'll be, but, you know, I think so much, unfortunately, the mechanics of what we've come used to as part of the theatrical process of trailers and advertising and marketing now happens so much earlier, you know, it really happens at the festival level. So
was that 2010?
2009, actually.
Oh, was it 2009?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, I wasn't really playing that game, you know, and partly I didn't, you know, maybe I didn't. I mean, I guess I could have, you know, I don't want to say I don't know how because, you know, I guess I can pretend to be P.T. Barnum a little bit if, you know, if a film about a strongman, you know, you want to, you know, you can pretend to be a showman a little bit if you need to, but... But yeah, I mean, I guess it just wasn't my, at that point, it wasn't where my head was, and I didn't fully understand the way the system worked. So so I think that was probably a part of it, too. You know, it was my own ignorance. So.
And then you did get a theatrical that had to feel pretty.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, it wound up in 30 cities. So, but again, that was just pushing. And it was really, I mean, the nice thing about it, I think, was that, I mean, the downside was that I was really working it hard to get out there. But the upside was it, and of what happened, I think, with it was it took much longer, right? So that wasn't great from a – it's not great from a life point of view, and it's not necessarily great from a pure marketing point of view. I mean, you want to have a very clear path when you're marketing a film, like open in New York and get great reviews ideally and get great numbers and take it around the rest of the country. And instead, I sort of like was just taking – you know, I'd talk to a theater that I thought would be a good fit, and if that theater liked it, they would play it. Mm-hmm. And so it never really had the very planned...
And they would have to be... I understand. There was no master strategy place in the sense of... Well, you knew you wanted to approach all these independent theaters and have theatricals and... Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think what happened was, as a result, is it never really had the you know, immediate hit that films often do. But what it did have was people who fell really in love with the film and became very passionate about it. You know, it was like programmers who saw it realized, okay, this is a film that's coming out of nowhere almost, and we really love it, you know. And it wasn't, they weren't booking it because there was a sales agent saying this is the next big thing, or because there was a distributor saying this is the thing that we're going to dump lots of money into advertising or anything. That it was just being played because people really loved it, you know.
So it was organic.
Yeah, I mean... as much as any of these things can be, I guess, you know, I mean, I don't think if you just, you know, I'm not, it would be ideal that if something's just sitting there, people can just discover it and find it. And maybe that will happen now, you know, that now that it is in a place where consumers can directly find it. But.
Well, I just also remember you being very available. That was my recollection. I just thought, oh, this is unique. What's the story here, you know?
Well, I mean, I think you have to be. You know, it's like, I'm not hands-on. Who else is going to be?
Right, yeah. Like, no, but that's truly, what made you were DIY, you know?
I mean, you have to be. I mean, I think that... Yeah. It's a film I care about, you know, and I still, to this day, I mean, in some ways, it's a film that you don't spend this much of your life on this film if it doesn't resonate with you in some way.
Yeah.
And so I cared about the film, and, you know, I wasn't going to, at the last stage, I wasn't going to run 25 miles and then for the last mile sit down on the ground, you know?
Yeah.
It was like, and I don't think any film, I mean, I think every filmmaker, when you make a film and you put so much of yourself into it, you're going to, you believe, you know? It's like
you're running to the stretch.
Yeah.
To the finish line.
And hopefully you cross with a smile on your face.
Yeah. So. For those who don't know, Strongman follows the, I would say midlife,
I don't know if you say crisis, but midlife.
No, I wasn't going to say crisis, actually. I was just going to say a segment of Stan, who, or as he's known in the business, is Stanless Steel. That's his performance name. And he is sort of at a point of reckoning, maybe, with his career and his life. And he's also has to make a living, so he does that. But he's trying to figure out where his passion fits in. And because he's so committed to it, and he refuses to accept failure. And in doing so, you know, his lifestyle suffers, his relationships suffer, right?
Oh yeah, okay.
Yeah. You know, I mean, dramatically.
You're looking at me like, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
Actually, I mean, I don't want to answer the same question.
Yeah.
But
so anyway, his girlfriend Barbara, which is shocking to the point, is I will give away one spoiler, and only that he is still with his girlfriend Barbara. So yeah. If you see it, you'd be surprised at certain points during the. The film that their relationship is still
at certain points, but I think you also there's other points too, which I think you'd feel absolutely. I think you'd feel why they could
be a fit. Yeah, right. So. But I think the things that are etched eternally in my mind and memory are her introductions that sort of come up throughout the film, where you know he's putting her through paces. He proudly has Barbara involved in his shows by way of introducing him, and they provide us some of the comic relief in the film, but also it's touching because he wants some, you know, it's her also kind of struggling with comfort of doing something that's definitely out of her comfort zone, but she does for some sense of loyalty and perhaps love for Stan.
Yeah. They're nice moments. There was the one, I think there's that one in the middle of the night that they did in this park, in a parking lot.
Yeah.
And I remember when I filmed that knowing like that, hey, that's a scene which is going to be in the finished film. I knew it when I shot that, you know, so.
Yeah.
So many of these scenes, you don't necessarily know where they're going to
Not
wind
because
up.
There's too few, like they're all cinematic.
Yes.
In this case.
Oh, yes. Yeah,
whereas other people, it might be this is mundane.
Oh, yeah.
And then they find the cinematic moment. Here, there was tons of cinematic things because his life is full of such a rich, it's very rich and dramatic, even though it's painful as well. We're talking with Zachary Levy, and tonight we're going to be showing Strongman in celebration of the DVD and digital release. And we're going to have Stan and Barbara, who we've been talking about, are going to be there. And so that I've never met either of them. I'm very excited to be meeting them tonight.
I didn't realize that you had it. Yeah.
No?
I mean, they haven't come to that many screenings.
Right.
Like,
well, the one at Brooklyn Heights, Stan was supposed to come
and then his truck problem. Barbara and her sister came the next night.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so that was Friday night. Stan was going to come. And then
and her sister's in it too.
Yeah, and so Barbara and her sister. And I think Linda's going to come tonight as well.
Oh, exciting. Has Linda come around? Is their relationship a little bit better?
Yeah, I think so. I think so.
Pure longevity. What was her reaction to the film?
She likes it.
Yeah.
Yeah, she likes the
film. As a result, did she have a little bit more? They had a very antagonistic relationship or adversarial or whatever. And I was wondering, did she come around after the film? And maybe did she have a depth of like to kind of get a better understanding of her brother-in-law? Or her quote-unquote brother-in-law?
Right. I don't know how much the film played into it, but yeah, it did. It does seem like they're on better terms now. You know,
I mean,
I think it wouldn't totally surprise me if that
part,
you know, like all these things sometimes are big circles. So could the wheel spin the other way again? Maybe it could, you know, but we actually did. So when I first played the film theatrically, I did a showing in Los Angeles, And I said, okay, it's Los Angeles, it has to be a quote-unquote big deal, so we have to get Stan and Barbara out. And then, you know, they came, and then, like, right before, like, maybe a couple of days before they came, Barbara calls me and says, Linda wants to come, too. So like, of course, I was like, oh, man, I don't know how this is going to work out. But they all ended up staying in the same hotel room. And maybe Linda had a separate room. I don't remember if she had a separate room or not, but they all were there together and it was fine and everyone had a good time. So.
And it's only after seeing the movie where you'll be able to understand what we're talking about in terms of these relationships and how complex they are. All right. So, yeah.
Can I ask you something?
Yeah, yeah.
Since this is your anniversary show, wouldn't it be better that ask you some questions rather than you ask me?
It's not really my anniversary show. That was, I think we were trying to do that. Yeah, yeah.
It was a month ago. So this is the 25th month of your show.
Wow. I guess so. I don't even think about it anymore. Yeah. Something like that. Maybe. But we don't even need to be so formal about it.
Right.
Yeah. We can do it. Sure, sure. Yeah. So we had talked about that if you came back on, I think, that you had come up with the idea of maybe turning the tables a little bit.
I didn't come up with this idea.
I thought you did. Okay.
I'm happy to do it, but it's not. I mean, it's more just like, you know, I think after 25 months, what people want to hear is your story.
Oh, I don't know. You know, it's funny because the people that were here before asked and I cut it. I'm definitely not going to play it because, you know, it's as role of the interviewer or moderator, you kind of leave a little. The mystery is kind of not a bad thing, but
okay.
But I could. I'll answer
okay.
it. I'm not. I'll.
Can I tell people that I think you grew up in Forest Hills?
Yes, you can tell them
okay.
that. Yeah. Yes, it's true. I've been outed. Sure. Yeah. I mean, these things are, I think, readily available a piece of information.
I don't think people know that.
No?
I don't think they know you're a New Yorker. I think you're just you come to all the events and the parties and they see you around and they say, there's Adam from Filmwax, but they don't know anything else.
All right. Yeah. Born and bred. Yeah. I was raised in Queens in Forest Hills and lived there until I went to school. And then I went to Bard.
Okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, because I only went for a year.
I see.
And then,
is it still on your resume?
That I went to Bard?
Did you? You're not like.
I don't think. No, I never put that on my resume because I put down Hunter.
Okay.
Yeah, because that's where I went after that, and I majored in history.
Huh. And then you worked in music for a while, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I had been a musician all my life.
Interesting.
I took jazz guitar for all through my childhood until I went off to college. So, and I was a pretty decent jazz guitar player.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And then I stopped, but I continued playing
guitar. Did you want to do that professionally?
Well, my guitar teacher actually said to me that I could. He said, you know, if you chose to be a jazz guitar player, you could do it. Which was, obviously that was 30 years ago, maybe a little less than that. And it stays with me. Like, you don't usually get somebody whose opinion you really revere. And then when they say that to you, like, I thought this guy was just the coolest guy in the world, Joe Monk. And he, you know, was a chain smoker. We'd keep each other in stitches through the whole thing. But he taught me incredible guitar music. And I learned the jazz songbook. I mean, a lot of it, you know, the American jazz songbook. And, my grandfather would come sometimes, and you know, when he was visiting up here, and my dad would come, and they'd sing with him. You know, I've got all the recordings because I record all the for practicing. You would have recordings to refer to, and those are great memories. Yeah, but I was never really passionate about jazz as a kid.
So, how did you start? Why did you start playing jazz then?
It was the teacher that my dad hooked me up with, and I just said, okay, I'll do it. Yeah, I need guitar lessons. I know I did want them. I had already been playing, but like folk music from summer camp, and then I had taken piano lessons even younger than that, and but that was classical, and I was also very good at that, but again, I didn't really want to be a classical musician. So
do you still play today?
I can accompany myself. I can play chords. That's basically all I could do on a piano, because I understand how to, in theory, so I can play any chord. But I don't have a keyboard, so I don't generally do it. I still play guitar, and I can still play some jazz guitar, but not very well. I subsequently, I wrote a lot of songs, but more pop songs.
And did you ever pursue that?
I did, actually, for a few years, yeah. in the 90s. I performed too, and but I kind of hated it. I liked it when it went well, but most often than not, it went.
What part didn't you like about it?
You have to like get people to come, and I was not.
So then you decided to start a film series where there's even less chance.
Well, but yeah, but it's true, Zachary. But the difference is that the films weren't mine.
Right.
So the pressure was off in that way. But it's true. There was a similarity in terms. I always felt like I needed. There was a pressure to get people to come out. But I felt so. I believed in the. Believe it or not, I think I believe more in the films that other people made than my own act, you know. And I didn't have the network that I have, like from this kind of work that I do. It was a smaller. I've had a band that I backed me up, like I would hire, basically. Huh. So it was a money losing.
Right.
Proposition, and I wasn't prolific, and that in of itself, because I could play solo, but that in of itself was the main reason I stopped doing it. I just could not. I wrote about 20 songs. I would say that 7 or 8 of them are quite good, actually, and to this day I'm proud of them. And there's a couple that I would say are as good as songs as anybody could write in terms of like a pop rock singer song, whatever you want to call it, but they were quite good. But I just, if I wasn't going to be prolific and write a bunch of songs, then it got boring really fast. I wasn't going to cover, do many, I did some covers too, but anybody could do that and better than me. So I got very, and I recorded all those songs in the studio, and the vocals were really bad in a bunch of them. I wasn't really unhappy with them. And then I did a bunch more and they were much better, much better.
There's not a guitar here, is there?
No.
Are you sure?
Yeah. No, I wouldn't.
You sure?
Well, I'll do it for you some other time.
You don't have anything on tape, do you?
Well, I do. I have them all on. I mean, all the songs are on CD or. Yeah, they're all are on MP3 at some point. Yeah.
I mean, there's people want to hear now.
No, they don't. I would say not.
I want to hear now.
Well, I'll eventually. I do pick up. Sometimes I jam with people. But I usually don't play my original songs. But some people.
I remember you posting something on Facebook about when George Jones died, something about playing George Jones.
When died?
When George Jones died.
Oh, George Jones,
I think you posted something about playing one of his songs, and that sort of caught my eye. It's like, oh, I didn't know that you played guitar.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, he was a favorite. And, you know, because I listened to every genre, and there was always certain musicians from every genre that I was, you know, would like. And I just liked the way he sang.
Yeah, he's a great singer.
You know, his phrasing was particularly extraordinary, I thought. I, of course, loved some of those Johnny Cash songs, but for me, George Jones was always a little bit more my personal favorite. So I used to play She Thinks I Still Care, because I like the irony of the song, you know. Any song that even suggests stalking a little bit, and even though that kind of doesn't really, but I guess. But I have a couple like that.
You're haunting the same old places.
Right. Yeah, She Thinks I Still... Even though he's obsessed with her, he's kind of ironically saying, you know, she thinks I still care.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, the truth is we all do, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, and it's kind of cool because I didn't know Stan, not to divert the conversation back necessarily, but Stan is also going to play with his band.
Yeah.
So maybe I'll sit in with Stan and a jamination, is that what it's called?
Yeah, it should be kind of intense. You know, they can be loud, I'll warn you. So I did order a box of industrial strength earplugs today.
Did you?
Yeah.
Are you, is
200 earplugs.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Well, I figured, well, you know, because there's an insurance requirement for this theater. So I thought about it, and I was like, well, I love going to live music, but I hate the next morning, like, my ears hurting. So.
Oh, when it's really loud.
Yeah. So, yeah. And I don't know how loud they're, I really don't. I don't want to scare people off.
No,
I don't know how loud they're going to be. But
okay, yeah,
I did
yeah.
think, like, all right.
No, but you're going to want to see it because you're going to be, after the movie, you're going to be like,
oh my God,
this is unbelievable.
Yes.
We're watching him do this after that movie. But yeah, I do, when I go to see live music, in a lot of cases, I will bring earplugs when I can remember. And it doesn't, no way does it diminish the quality.
No.
In fact, it only improves it because you're not
in pain.
Yeah, right. You don't have to worry about that.
And I know you have a birthday that's coming up or has just passed, right?
Mm-hmm.
But at least for me, as I've gotten older, I've become much more sensitive to loud noises.
Yeah, and Yeah, you're thinking also, yeah, you want to preserve your hearing, you know. It's true enough shows. Because, again, I did work at Sony Music, which I think you were asking me about, for 10 years, and I went to see a lot of live shows. And at a certain point, and a lot of those shows were at, like, Irving Plaza, Bowery Ballroom, the Ritz, these, you know, Roseland, these clubs that were, you know, modest in size. But the bands were pretty loud in a lot of cases, so... It wasn't like I was going to see Korn every night, right, you know. Right. It was, but it was just loud, you know. The amps are on 11.
I got the NASCAR approved earplugs.
Okay,
so,
very good.
And they're going to be free with the admission too. So even if you don't like the movie tonight, like I hope people will get, we'll leave with a pair of earplugs.
Okay, very good. And we'll say Stan will sign them too.
I think they might be too small, but.
But see, speaking of signing, Stan will be there, and he will be signing.
DVDs and CDs.
DVDs, of course. Yes. No, what am I saying? Right, he'll have maybe Jamination.
Yeah,
are they recorded?
Yeah, they are recorded, so he might.
But DVDs of Strongman.
Right.
And you'll be there, and I'll be there. And we urge you to come out and check out the film for our DVD release party. That, by the way, has been another really nice thing from doing a series. Is I think I've had the most fun at the DVD release parties.
Yeah, it should be fun. I hope people come out. I really do. It's like the film. I mean, every time it's strange because even though the film, it's a strange mix between being a secret in some ways and being a film that people really talk about and really feel passionate about. And it's like at every screening, there's always some combination of people who've seen the film already and like want to see it again, want to see it for a third or fourth time often, you know, just because it's really stuck with them. And every time they see it, they want to like get to the next layer of watching it. And then there's always some combination of people that haven't ever seen it, you know, and it's a totally new experience for them. And that's always really interesting to be there. You know, it always feels like a live event in some ways. So, so I hope you're part of it. You know, I hope people out there are part of it. So,
again, Wednesday at theater. Oh, we didn't mention where it was.
All right, it's at Theater 80, which can I say is, you know, I don't. You grew up in Forest Hills, but did you ever come to Theater 80 when you were growing up?
You know what? It's bizarre. I may have.
Right.
It's that, you know, because I did come into the city. The 80s, I would come in with friends or meet a friend in the village, and it's not beyond possibility that I did actually go to Theater 80. I don't recall though.
You might remember because it's pretty unusual. Like the lobby is unusual, and the seating arrangement's unusual. It used to be like back for people who aren't from New York or came to New York like at a later period. Like when I was growing up, I grew up in the I guess you'd say the 80s and 90s probably. Like during that period, and it might have started in the 70s. I'm not sure, but certainly in the 80s and 90s, they had a rep program where they would play like sort of classic. Mostly more Hollywood kinds of films, but it was like almost like a rotating program. It was like a Torah portion almost every night of a different classic film. And they play on 16mm prints. And the way that theater is shaped, it's very, it's sort of wider than it is deeper. And so the rake of the seats is pretty sharp. And there wasn't enough room to put the projector in the back of the theater. So what they had was they had a rear screen projection system.
I see.
So the projector would bounce off a mirror and then go to the screen. And it's a really big screen for the room, you know? So you really feel almost like you're in the movie. When you watch
it's almost like IMAX.
Yeah, it is in a way. I mean, it's maybe a mini IMAX in a way. Yeah, because you really feel like you're part of the movie in when you're sitting in those seats. So,
wow.
And I saw.
Wait.
Yeah, I mean, it's a real thrill to play there because I remember. I mean, it was one of the places that I really got a film education just watching. You know, they'd have a week of Hitchcock movies, and I'd go and you know,
right. Oh yeah, and
watch and
indulge.
So,
right.
Yeah.
Theater 80 is located at 80 St. Mark's Place. Just I think off First Avenue.
Yeah, it's between First and
west
Second,
of,
but closer
west of
to
First Avenue.
Yeah,
yeah,
closer to First.
And it's historic landmark of a spot, and they have a bar in there. So what we're going to do is we're going to show Strongman at around probably 7:15, but get there a little early because you can schmooze and get a good seat. And then we are asking for a $10 donation at the door, or you can go to the Facebook page, or You can go to filmwax.com or you go to strongman.com. Strongmanfilm.com, excuse me. And we'll put all this on the show, on my the show's pages, the show notes, the links to that. But you can go there and you can also get a link to the ticketing too also. And all goes to a very, very worthy cause. And then we're going to, again, show the film, which is going to be followed by Stan and his band at Jamination playing, and a cocktail hour. People can also indulge.
We'll mingle in the bar and sign autographs.
Can we make an announcement about? No? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Almost.
We might
be able to put it on the webpage.
Yeah, so later, check the show page on my Rooftop Films, the page for the show. If you're on iTunes, then go over to filmwaxradio.com you can check out some of the details of the event there. So whether or not we're looking at a sponsorship basically, which could mean, could be good news. So if any luck, we'll have our beer sponsor and you might be able to get a very good deal indeed.
Yeah.
If not, fuck it. So there'll be signing of DVDs and possibly album CDs and
postcards
whatnot.
And I think anyone who's seen the movie really, I think, understands what a unique person Stan is.
Right.
How, and also Barbara, too,
Sure, really, of course. I mean, can't wait to meet them.
One of the
both.
I remember when we did this screening at Rooftop and we did this stunt afterwards where Stan lay down in the street and the pickup truck drove up on his chest.
Mm-hmm.
And Barbara was there and, like, all these people from the crowd were like, we love you, Barbara. They really, there's this real love for Barbara, too, and people watching this film. So I think if you come, you will enjoy meeting them. So, and I know they would be thrilled to meet people. So.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure that's why they're coming in the first place. It'll be fun for many reasons.
Yeah.
That's, again, Wednesday tonight, October the 23rd. The fun starts at 7 o'clock at Theater 80 in Manhattan. Zachary Levy, thanks for coming back on FilmWax Radio.
Pleasure,
again, let's not wait again this long.
Okay, absolutely. My pleasure. Yeah.
All right, thanks.
Thank you for listening. That was episode 171. I have a couple of really extra special shows coming up in the works, including my conversation with the two independent filmmakers. Both have made, I guess you could say both have made films in the gay genre, but really that's to minimize it. They're both really don't need to be described that way other than great storytelling. Stacy Passan made a film called Concussion, which is currently in theaters, and Jonathan Lisecki, of course, an old friend of FilmWax Radio, made Gaby last year, and which is available on digital platforms right now. So you can check that out. That's coming up next week. And then shortly after that, the folks that created the web series High Maintenance and just much more, of course. Don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes, please, and tell your friends. But subscribe on iTunes. It takes just a moment. Leave a rating. Leave some comments about what you think about the show, or you can do so also on our Facebook page. Thank you so much. Thanks, guys. This is Adam Shartoff, your host of FilmWax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films and AT&T, signing off. Until next week.